Okay, so last week we discussed two customs of the Seder. This week we'll discuss three more. Hopefully we'll get through all of them, and at the end Nancy will present. Okay.
Can I just make one suggestion?
Sure.
Skip number 16, because I have covered a lot of that material in mine. I've used some of the same sources as Rabbi Goldman.
Oh, okay. So then I will briefly, so I'll leave it till the end, and it'll be a lead-in to yours then. Okay?
You don't have to go into detail, otherwise I'll have nothing to say.
Okay, fine. So then let us skip then to number 17, okay? To number 17. Okay, so this is a custom that I've seen it at many different seders, though I want to put a little bit of a twist on it. So at many seders that I've been at, people give out candy or treats or something to the kids when they answer a question or they sing a song or whatever it might be. Because as we know, the Seder is about, so much of the Seder is focused on education. So we,
this is just my brother-in-law. When a child asks a question, he gives them a quarter. He has a whole pile of change. And the kids are so wanting the money. They'll look at it and they'll ask a question. It's amazing.
Good. So that's actually what we're going to come to right now.
Okay.
So many people, do this for answers and answers to questions and for songs. But as you know, I don't know if your brother knew this, but the original source of this custom, as it appears in the Talmud, is actually not that way. It's actually the way that your brother does it, which is to give out things not for answers, but for questions. For the questions.
Yeah.
Right? If you look here at 17, so this is the Talmud 109a, right? It was related of Rabbi Akiva that he used to distribute parched ears and nuts to children on the eve of Passover so they might not fall asleep, but ask the questions. Now, Wikipedia in 18 records the mistaken custom, which is families will follow the Haggadah's lead by asking their own questions at various points of the Haggadah and offering prizes such as nuts and candies for correct answers. Right, this misperception that you're supposed to give out candies for the correct answers is so pervasive. And sometimes Wikipedia is a very helpful source to know what people have accepted. But it's incorrect. And as we see here in the Talmud, in Psachim, the actual custom from the Talmud is to give out treats for questions. And in 19, I just note that last year when I was in Alon Shvut, I was living in Israel. So in the shul on Seder night, where this is 17, 18, 19, these sources. So I was in shul in Alon Shvut at night. Arayol Ben Nun, who's one of the rabbis who lives in the community, he's not the rabbi of the shul, he's one of the teachers in the yeshiva there, but he lives in the community. And he noted that the Talmud says that the reason you give out, in the Talmud's time, nuts, because that was the treat, was for questions. So on Seder night in shul, he's very into emphasizing the original source of customs. He had people positioned at different points around the shul, and he said, at this point, I ask all the kids to ask me questions, and every kid who asked a question, he had one of the people who was walking around give them nuts, just so he could go back to the original custom. Now, of course, that opened it up to interesting things, right? Some of the kids asked questions that were Seder related. One of them asked him how old he was. You never know what you're going to get. But just to focus on this for a minute, I think that this distinction between what has developed in many places and is pervasive in Wikipedia, as opposed to what the Talmud says and what your brother-in-law does and Rabbi Ben Nun does, of giving food for the answers as opposed to the questions, highlights something very fundamental about the Seder and perhaps something where we've gotten it wrong. Because the Wikipedia custom, if we want to call it that, develops in the culture now where people are extremely educated and their kids, whether it be from school or Sunday school or from past Seders, know the answers that they're expected to give. And everyone thinks that the value of the Seder is rehashing all the truths that we know from last year. And they all have the things they want to say about the Seder and they want to show off the Manishtana. But the real point of the Seder is to learn something new. And the Talmud notes, I mean, that I didn't put this here, but the original Manishtana, the four questions, the Talmud has a discussion where some of the rabbis were sitting at the table and one of the kids just raised his hand and said, "What is that?" And he said, "I fulfilled my obligation of the questions," because those questions were just, you know, examples of questions that someone might ask, but not necessarily the questions they had to ask. The point of Seder night is to encourage people to ask questions. And this works very well with what we already noted last week, that according to some positions, such as the Pri Chadash, the reason for Karpas is simply an icebreaker. It has no answer. We're just getting them to ask questions. We want to pique people's curiosity. And I think the distinction between the Talmud's custom of giving out candy and treats for the asking of questions rather than the right answer highlights the real purpose of the Seder. And even if we think as we go through the Haggadah, you have Manishtana, which is however many questions is in Manishtana. Parenthetically, how many questions, since we'll have a little bit of extra time, how many questions are in Manishtana?
Five, six maybe.
So anywhere from five to one. Right? The actual majority position and the most grammatically correct position is probably one. Right? Richard Steiner, Professor Richard Steiner notes this, and if we actually think about it, it's right, the only question is Manishtana Laila, what quality of the night makes it different? And then we highlight four differences that point to its distinctiveness. But the real question is, what is it about Seder night that makes it different, as evidenced in the fact that we have matzah and not chametz, that we have maror or not the other vegetables, that we lean and don't sit straight, that we dip twice and not dip once. Right? It's really one big question. And the goal of the night is to answer the one big question. What is that quality? What is it about Seder night that makes it unique in all these ways? Okay, so that is just, I think, something that is worth thinking about when we go into Seder night, the centrality of the asking the questions and not necessarily getting the quote-unquote right answer.
Can I ask you, what are arched ears?
I think they are, that you actually, you can get this a little bit in Israel. It's a treat, like, it's like toasted grains. I think that's what they gave out. I don't know if you see, in Israel, if you go to the shuk, you'll see they do this with corn. They like toast corn, just actual the kernel. It's not like popcorn. It's like crispy. It's the corn with like some salt and you roast it. It's like very good. It's like a salty treat. I'm assuming that's what it was, something like that. I'm not really sure, but I assume that was what they used. Now, of course, if you want to get people to ask, instead of candy, you know, you can go back to the, you can go back, not, don't use, well, don't use grain. Bad idea. Or corn if you don't eat kidney yet. Or find something. I don't know. Maybe not. Forget that. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. But okay, fine. So parched ears. I'm not really sure exactly what they're using. But okay. Now, I think since if I'm not going to focus so much on the next one, so maybe I'll add something I actually didn't put in the sources because I saw it this week. But I'll note it here since we have a little bit of extra time. I found another perspective this week on actually what does it mean that we do things as a hekera litinokot, as a way of doing something different for the kids. In a very nice article by Rav Breuer in his book Pirkei Moedot, so he actually suggests something which is, I think, very clever. And he argues that he doesn't like the answers that we saw last week. The reason we do, let's say, karpas is simply to get people to ask, but there's no answer to it. He thinks that's half true. And he notes that the original Seder, we go back to the time of the temple. So let's imagine the order of the Seder. How does it work? You start with what?
With the table of contents.
Right. So yeah, you start, right? We start the same way. We start, now we have Kiddush, and then let's say we wash our hands, we have the vegetables, we break the matzah, then what? So what's the next thing we have? The story. We have Magid, right? After we break the matzah. Now, everyone wonders, well, why do we break the matzah now? Why do we have Karpas now? Right? We're going to have Magid now. So he notes that he thinks it's all a I would say historical fluke, but we'll see that's not really what I mean, right? He said, in the time of the temple, so what was the next step? After you break the matzah, what's the fifth thing you do?
Eat.
So that's what we do. What do they do in the temple?
Did they go straight to the sacrifice?
Yeah, they eat. Mm-hmm. Now, why do they eat? Why do they eat first? Because...
concentrate when they're listening.
Well, more than more, even more than that, the sacrifice had to be eaten by midnight. The whole sacrifice, with no leftovers, the whole sacrifice had to be eaten. So the first thing you did was have the sacrifice. That was what you were supposed to do. You had the Paschal offering. Once you were in the middle of the meal, which was going to go long because you have to eat an entire sheep, in addition to whatever else you're eating, then you told the story over the offering, the matzah, and the maror. So in the original Seder, the order would have been Kadesh, right, the Kiddush, then we wash our hands with Orchatz, then we have Karpatz with the vegetables, and then we have Yachatz where we break the matzah. Then we eat the Karban Pesach, we eat the offering with the matzah and the maror, and we tell the story during the meal.
So this eliminates my uncle's favorite question, which was, when do we eat?
Yeah. Exactly, you eat at the beginning. But he notes, so now, in the original, he said a lot of things that make no sense at our Seder suddenly made a lot of sense. For example, karpas. We said, why do you have karpas? Because it's meant as the first dip to get into the meal, right? On the very simple level, right? And it's supposed to, other people said that it's supposed to highlight the uniqueness of the maror. Well, in hours, it's a few hours till the maror, right? Think about the problem. The kids are asking Manashtana about the maror, which they haven't seen yet. Right? Because, well, he said, well, in the original Seder, that didn't happen. Because first you had karpas, then you had yachatz, you broke the matzah, you went straight into the meal. So the karpas was right before you were about to wash your hands and have the maror. It drew attention to it. And the manishtana happened after. They've already seen that we've leaned. They've already seen that we dipped twice. They've already seen everything. And he said, the breaking of the matzah makes a lot of sense. Why do you break the matzah? Well, you break the matzah because you're about to eat the matzah, right? You need to break the matzah because it needs to be poor man's bread, so it needs to be a partial one. You don't break it 2 hours before you're going to eat the matzah. You do it right before you eat the matzah, right? And everything makes sense. So he said, okay. But then now we can go back and say, well, then what does that mean when we say we do karpas now so the kids will ask? He said, it's not that they'll ask and there's no answer. There is an answer. The answer is, this makes no sense nowadays because we don't have the temple. If we had the temple, this would make sense. And he said, we retained the structure from the temple to draw attention to the fact that our Seder is incomplete. Right? We continue to do things that don't make sense in context to draw attention to the fact that there was a context in which it did make sense. So it used to be the Manashtana happened after we'd seen everything. Now we put the Manashtana at the beginning to highlight the fact that our Seder doesn't look that way. Which I thought was a very clever way of drawing attention to the fact that at our Seder, not only are we dealing with the question of what are we doing now? What is the meaning behind what we're doing now? What does it represent? We're also commemorating what was. And he notes, therefore, that we understand something else. The first paragraph in Magid, when we tell the story, before even the Manashtana is? It's before that. First thing in Magid is, anyone have a Haggadah? Even before. Is what? Halach Ma'anya. This is the poor man's bread. But what does it say? Everyone wonders, what is it doing here? Well, what does the paragraph say? Anyone who wants to eat the Karban Pesach, anyone who wants to sacrifice, come here. Right? And then what's the last paragraph? The last sentence in the paragraph? This year we're slaves and next year we'll be free. So what is that line doing here? He said that's what it's doing. That's the introduction. That says it. Now we're not eating the Karban Pesach yet. And we're doing this weird out of order Seder because we're here. If the temple was around, we would skip from this point to the food and come back. Right? The reason we're doing the matzah and telling the story before eating is only because this year we are here and not in the temple. If we were in the temple, everything would be rearranged. So that sentence is the...
So we're telling a story from the past, the temple that was.
And we're looking.
Will ever there be another temple? And then we would have to change it.
Exactly. And we would just move it.
Will there? Could there be? Israel exists now? Why? I'm serious. Like, I don't understand. We're talking about a past event. And, you know, Vishana Hababa Yerushalayim. We're in Yerushalayim. So what? I'm trying to understand, you know, why can't we make it more present?
Meaning, the
temple. We're talking about a past story,
right?
We're trying to make it very experiential, which is very helpful for the children. But we keep saying "Bashana haba Yerushalayim," and I never. We're here.
Sure.
I was going to ask about the fits. I was taught that there are three time frames of Pesach, and you're talking about part of them, but you're making a distinction. I was taught there's three kinds. Pesach of the past, which is what happened in Egypt.
Okay.
Pesach of the future, when we will be redeemed, fully redeemed in God's presence, whether it's the Mashiach or the world to come, I don't know. And then there's Pesach of the present, which we're in now. What you're teaching us is there's two kinds of present between the Pesach of Egypt and the Pesach of their full redemption. There's the kind which was with the temple and the kind without the temple.
Right. There's,
so there's
four,
past,
let's say. Sure.
Two presents, there's... and a future full.
Right,
so
that we're looking back to a past in a hope that the elements of it will be in the future one.
Right,
yeah.
Right. We're practicing for the future in a way.
Exactly, right, we're both looking, right, yes, exactly.
So we're enacting and we're practicing. I don't know when the future's coming, so
that's
back to your question.
That's
back to your question.
Look, Maimonides says no one will know what it looks like until it gets here, so I'm going to claim that whatever it will look like, you know, what the temple, you know, temple sacrifices, whatever it will look like, you know, majority of rabbinic, authorities assume there will be a temple with sacrifices. Some think that only some of the sacrifices, or only the Rav Kook suggests only the mincha sacrifices, right, the flower offerings and not the animal offerings. What it's going to look like, when it comes, I'll figure it out. No one's asking me what it should look like. I mean, now you are, but no one, but most people are asking other people, so I'm going
to
leave it to them.
Look like if we want it to, we have to know.
It's true, but I'm gonna say, you know, Lesk, you're.
This might be the future. I don't know.
It could be. For I have no idea. I always assume that, you know, the future will continue to improve. What it will look like at some point is anybody's guess.
You're optimistic.
What?
You're very optimistic.
I'm very optimistic, yeah.
To which authority were you referring? I came in late when you were quoting the Rambam. Pesach is out of order.
That's in Rav Mordechai Breuer's book, Pirkei Moedot, which I was reading this week. So, okay. So that's on this. It's a good question. I don't know. You know, I don't know. You can ask Reich Tirchiner. How about that? Well, Okay. Let's move to another custom. This is actually a law, but we'll include it under custom for this purpose, and that is the question of leaning. So as we know, we lean during the Seder, when we drink the cups, when we eat the matzah. And as the Talmud notes here in 20, even the impoverished in Israel may not eat until he leans. So everyone has to lean. Now, there is a, we'll skip for a second to 22. Okay. Now there is a dispute. It's clear that the theme of Seder night is freedom, is wealth, is we feel like we're free, we're celebrating the Seder. So it's clear that in the time of the Talmud, the reason people leaned was because that was what people did. They leaned. Now, nowadays, we can go in one of two directions. There are people who think that, and this is what the Torah quotes in 22, this is Rabbi Yaakov Balaturin, the son of Rabbeinu Asher, living in the 13th century, citing Ravia, citing another German authority. He writes that some people think that if it used to be that the way people sat the wealthy people sat, was leaning, but nowadays wealthy people don't lean at the meal, so we shouldn't lean. And there are authority, there were medieval authorities, though that nowadays we don't lean. Because we don't lean. We're supposed to be free. The reason you lean is for freedom. And now we sit up straight at a table. Okay? There are others who think that's not the case. And they think that there's more to it. Because it's not just leaning. It's leaning, yes, to be free. But is it so we can express freedom? Or is it a reenactment of freedom? Right? Now, if you think it's a reenactment of freedom, right? It's not just our own freedom, but that we're trying to imagine we were there. So then what did freedom look like then? So here again, the wonderful authoritative source of Wikipedia in 21, on the Wikipedia entry, Ancient Roman Cuisine. So they record that the custom looked like this. The dinner was consumed in a special dining room, which later was to be called triclinium. Okay, whatever that is exactly. Triclinium, okay. Here one would lie down on a specifically designed couch, the lectus triclinarius. Around the round table, the mensa, three of these lecti were arranged in the shape of a horseshoe, so the slaves could easily serve, and a maximum of three diners would recline at each lectus. During the kingdom and early republic, the only people allowed a place on the lectus were men. But the late Republic and imperial times, were especially among the aristocracy, women were permitted to recline during meals. Traditionally, women would dine sitting upright across from their husbands or fathers in chairs. More tables for the beverages stood beside the couches. All heads were oriented towards the central table, with left elbows propped on a cushion and feet at the outside of the dinner couch. In this fashion, at most nine people could dine together at one table. Further guests had to sit on chairs. Slaves normally had to stand. So what you see from the original custom was that this was specifically not just it wasn't just that wealthy people leaned. It was leaning was a sign that you were free because the slaves stood, right? And the higher you were up in society, the more likely you were to lean. People who were in between sat, right? Now, being the fact that this was ancient Rome, only the women at the highest rungs of society leaned. Most women did not because they were at a lower rung of society. This always reminds me of I don't know if you read Dave Barry at all. Do you read Dave Barry at all? He's a comic reader he's in Florida. So he has a book on politics. Dave Barry hits below the beltway, I think. So he goes through the history of the world, of world politics. And he said, the Roman Empire became great through a government known as democracy, which translates as dem, meaning everyone is free, and ocracy, which means except women, slaves, and poor people, of course, right? The ancient world's view of freedom. So leaving aside what was going on in the ancient world, the details of it, the point was that the leaning wasn't just a sign of wealth, it was specifically that which drew attention to the fact that you were free, as opposed to the slaves who were standing, or the people who were lower rungs of society who were sitting. Now, if it's true that leaning isn't just to act free ourselves, but to try to imagine what did freedom look like through history, so then leaning isn't, people always have this like awkward leaning thing. They sort of like slump over on the chair next to them or they're the person next to them, right? And people make it. It was, right? Because, again, if we would sharpen the issue, is there are two ways of viewing leaning. Either leaning is because we're supposed to feel free, in which case the logical extension of this would be what the Rav Yah says, which is that nowadays when that's not how free people sit, we shouldn't do it. The other possibility is that it's an attempt at reenactment. But if it's an attempt at reenactment, this awkward, sitting isn't a great thing. It does it sort of. But the standard position that we do lean, Rav Yah was not accepted, as Rabbi Yosef Karo notes in 23, that Rav Yah is an individual opinion in this matter, meaning that the position of all the poskim, all the authorities, that one must always lean even nowadays. So what some people do is if you want to take it to its logical extreme and you really want to get across the point that what you're trying to do is relive the ancient Seder, so some people I know Now, the one I know, if anyone knows him, will understand why this is funny, but one of the Rosh Yeshiva, the yeshiva I went to for many years, Rabbi Yaakov Maidan, loves being a little bit, doing things a little bit differently. So what he said he's done for years, and he says it works great because it really gets everyone involved, is he clears out his dining room table, he moves away his dining room table, moves it to the side, takes out his couches, moves all the couches into a circle, and takes off the cushions and sets up as many cushions, pillows as he can around the room, and recreates an old Roman sitting thing, right? And they
slaves.
The slaves he doesn't have, that much he doesn't have. You know, there's a limit to how much we can recreate the ancient world. And they sit around,
they lie down
on these like couch-like things, and they recreate the Seder. Now, what do they eat on? Well, if you know in who has a Haggadah here, you have a Haggadah here, right? So, El Halach Manya, it says here we cover the Seder plate or remove the Seder plate, right? Something like that, right? There are various points where whatever. Right, we cover the Seder plate, remove the Seder plate, whatever we do. Right, so we lift up the matzah after Halach Manya, we cover it with different points. We cover it. That's not the original custom either. The way the Talmud records it is at those points you remove the table. Now, what is removing the table? This is not, you don't remove this thing. Well, what they used to do is it was basically like a those TV tables. Right, those little things, because each person was lying at their own couch, and they had a little tray table. So when you removed the table, you removed the table. The table was just big enough to fit your plate. You pick that thing up, and it's like I have one of those for my sukkah that I borrowed from my in-laws. Right, I go out of my little sukkah, and like you don't bring out the table, you bring out enough to fit your plates. Right, so because you can carry it in and out. So he recreates the Seder with all these little tables and these cushions, right? And he said it works very well educationally. Now, I don't know if people want to do it. I've known other people who have taken it on. They say it's a nice addition at least once in a while. It takes a lot of work and a lot of planning. But it is definitely a way of getting people to ask and getting people to experience the fact that the Seder is not just about experiencing our freedom as it is now, but it's also about reliving the freedom as other people have experienced it. Okay, I'm going to leave the next custom.
It's not as other Jews have experienced it. It's other people.
Other people. Now, the Jews were living in the Roman culture, so they did do that.
They lay down.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, think about the Esther story, right? The Esther story. Right, fall on the bed. What bed? Right? They're lying on three beds. Right? There are three beds around tables. So when Ahasuerus goes out and Haman goes to talk to Esther, she's on a bed. That's why it looks so bad, right? It's not sitting up. Right? If Esther was sitting up straight, what? Yeah, they were like low tables. Yeah, maybe more like the Japanese tables on the floor.
To eat at a low table is to either sit on the floor.
Right, or lie down. Exactly, and that's what he's doing. But now you understand what's going on there, right? Because it's not like she's sitting up straight and Haman is here talking to her, right? She is on a bed and he's on the floor leaning over her on a bed,
right,
begging her, right? Like at head level, like with his head over her face, right? You can understand why this looks terrible when Ahasuerus walks back in and he says, "Agam lichbash namalka imi babayit," right? Are you trying to conquer the queen while I'm in the house? Because that's what it looks like when you're eating on bed. So what he does is he recreates this. And again, I've known other people to try it at least once, because of the educational value. Okay, I will come back to this, and then it will lead into to Nancy's in a minute, but I guess we have a little bit of extra time because I'm not going to go through that one in detail. So I'll just mention some other customs we don't have on the sources. So okay. So one, just a few that come to mind that I think are nice to think about. So one, there's a general dispute in the Talmud of whether one must have intent before one performs a mitzvah. The Chaye Adam, writing in the 19th century, argues that whatever one thinks, the Seder specifically, because the goal of the Seder is not just to perform the acts, but to learn the message from things that no matter what you think in general, it's important to have intent on the night of the Seder, to fulfill the command of telling the story of going out of Egypt, and suggest even articulating that at the beginning of the Seder. Now, when I saw that, I think it's just a nice thing. You know, it probably wouldn't hurt if at the beginning of our Seder, we didn't just launch into it, but we noted that we're actually trying to do something here. We're trying to accomplish, we're trying to actually sort of feel that we went out of Egypt. We're telling the story with that in mind, and that's why we're going through this, right? Even just articulating it helps us concentrate on the goal of the Seder, which I think is something that would be helpful. Another thing, this is not really a halachic custom, but something that I think we're going to do this year at my Seder, which, depending on the age of kids that you have at your Seder, could be helpful. One thing I know some people do at the Makot, at the plagues, is to get props, right? Right. So, and I will just note that this is helpful, right? My 3-year-old, when we go into stores now where they're selling the props, he knows what they are already, right? He's like, the frogs, frogs. And again, as you see in the Talmud, so much of what we do at the Seder is to try to keep the kids awake. Whatever we can do to keep them awake, you know, that is, that is to be welcomed. A point I would throw out on Dayenu. Dayenu comes at an interesting point of the Seder. Right before that, we have the central part of the Seder, the story part of the Seder, which is ironically not actually the story as is found in Shemot, as found in Exodus, is actually from Dvarim, which is actually from the laws of the first fruit, where a farmer would, when he had his first fruit, would bring his fruits to the temple, right? He would bring it to the Beit HaMikdash, and he would bring the Bikurim, and he would tell this little story, and he would say, Arami Oved Avei, right? My father was a wandering Aramean, or an Aramean tried to make my father wander, or however exactly you translate it. And then we went down to Egypt, and then we took out of Egypt, and then we got to this point, and I bring my first fruits to the Seder. Now, if you actually look in your Haggadah, you're the only person who has Haggadah. So if you skip to that point, right? If you skip to that point, to that end of it, the Arami Oved Avi little story. So to the end of it, it's right before Dayenu, right?
That was a good hint.
Right before Dayenu, right? So we find not just the verses there, but we find rabbinic exegesis around it, right? We go, Arami Oved Avi, and then that's where the Seder gets really long, right? It's, my father was a wandering Aramean, as it says, and it tells a story. And we went down to Egypt, and they enslaved us, as it says, etc., etc., etc. And then we, right, there's these pages. Right. The pages and pages and pages of it, right? Now, if you actually look in the Chumash, if you actually look in the Torah, you'll notice that not only is it a little bit strange that we pick this unit as opposed to, let's say, parts of Exodus that tell the story, we actually leave out the last verse in that unit. And the last verse there is imagine the farmer, right, is, and now you've brought us to the temple and here is the fruit. And we just leave out that verse. We just don't say it at all. The Tashbetz, writing in the 14th century, is an interesting suggestion. He says, actually, no, we don't leave it out at all. And he said, Dayenu. Dayenu, what's the last sentence in Dayenu? Right, the last sentence, number 15. Right? You brought us to Israel and you hadn't built the temple, would have been enough, which means that we end with the temple. And he actually argues that what is Dayenu? Dayenu is the end of the story. We start with this story and we say, well, this is what happened in Egypt. And then, well, the verse is actually pretty quiet. It just says, and then we got to the temple. Well, what happened between step A and step Z? Whatever. It takes me a long time to not say it as an American. I have to think about it every time. Okay. Z or Z? fine. It's even worse because my name starts with it. Like, it's like, I can't. So, right? 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 We say Arami Oveda V, right? My father was a wandering Aramean, and then they sent us down to Egypt, and then he took us out, but we leave out the last verse, which was of the farmer bringing his first fruits and said, and you've brought us to the... You've brought us to the temple. So the Taj Beit says, no, we don't. What is Dayenu? Dayenu is drawing the connection from Egypt to the temple. We fill in every detail. How did we get from there? Because these five verses don't tell us. So what we do is we fill in the details in between. And we say, it took this, and we went, right, we got the Torah, and we got the man, and we came to Israel, and we got the temple, etc., etc., etc.
Isn't this interesting? Because this, what you're saying explains a line that I've always had trouble with, because it says, and we got to the temple, and we can give sacrifices to be forgiven our sins. And I think, that's the whole point, our sins? Mm-hmm. It's very weird.
Right, and the point is that what it does is it's bringing to us to the temple, which is where this farmer is now, you know, standing. Now, this is first of all interesting because it explained what Dayenu was doing at that point in the Seder, but it also adds something which I think is important, is that, as we've noted, Seder night is not just is about multiple things. On the one hand, it's about reliving the story of Egypt. But the fact that the central text of the Seder is not their story, but is the farmer's story, tells us that we, right, Soloveitchik said, why the farmer? Partially because, who are we? Are we the people actually leaving? Or are we the farmer trying to relive the Seder? We're the farmer trying to relive the Seder. We weren't there. This farmer is doing the same thing we're trying to do. He's trying to relive the Seder. So we pick that as our central text. But if that's the case, then what does Dayenu show? The farmer, or us, it's not just enough to talk about Egypt. We also have to think about what freedom means to us, because the Dayenu is the Seder, is the farmer saying, and how did I get to this point? Not what happened then, but then what happened since then? God took us this, which took me to this point where now I'm celebrating and I'm bringing my first fruits. And a lot of people at the Seder have the custom to talk not just about the freedom of the Seder, of what happened then, but their own personal stories of freedom in addition. Well, I think that custom in many ways comes from what Dayenu really is, right? It's how do we trace the story of the Exodus back into our lives? How did we get from that point to today? Dayenu is the farmer's version of it. But I think Dayenu just begs us to add our own story into it. I think that is part of the message of the Seder. The fact that we use this text, the central text of someone living hundreds of years later, thousands of years later, coming to the temple and explaining his story, how he got to the Seder, I think that really does emerge from this custom of Dayenu, which is, you know, everyone's either favorite or least favorite part, depending on how hungry you are by that point, right? And depending on whether your family insists on doing Dayenu round each of the 15 times, or you do what my family does, which is first and last, and then the middle, just Dayenu once, because, like, by that point, you know, we... There, I've given you a custom from my Seder is cut Dayenu shorter by just saying the word Dayenu once. So we do it at the first and the last, you know, the Dayenu. We sing, my son loves Dayenu. He loves Dayenu. He sings it all year long. He sang it since last year. So I don't know if he's going to let us do that this year. We may have to go through 15 rounds of it, but yeah.
So I was once told that a different explanation for the reason Dayenu was there and why it's sung and why it's, you know, there's chronology. It's like a stepping up and one Dayenu builds on the other. It clearly cannot be a physical chronological thing, because if we stopped in the middle, we wouldn't ever get to it. Or if we stopped after one, it wouldn't be at all sufficient to get to the end of the song. So the teacher is the reason we say Dayenu, not because it was enough that you did that for us and we would have lived happily ever after, but what you did was enough for us to finally have faith in you.
Right. I mean, Dayenu probably doesn't mean it would have been enough, but enough that we would have had to thank you, right? Enough that we would...
Enough to leave.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Which is, I think, a nice addition. Okay, I'll throw out one more and then I'll move to this one, which is right, the end of the Seder, all the way to the end, right? We have all these songs, right? Everyone's exhausted. We got a whole list of songs. So, Echad Miyodea, who knows one? Now, why is that there? Why is that there at the end of the Seder? It's a nice song, right? It was our favorite when we were growing up, and I'm sure that my sister and I will go at it this year until 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, whatever it is. Maybe. We'll see. My sister is still exhausted, recovering from, you know, wedding exhaustion. She only got married 3 weeks ago, so. And she's coming with her new husband to the Seder, so we'll have fun. So this is not clear first Seder. But second Seder, it's actually quite clear because we start a mitzvah on the second night of second night of Pesach, which in Israel is not a Seder, but in America, Canada is a Seder, right? We start a mitzvah. This is not a custom anymore. It's a mitzvah. What mitzvah do we start second day of Pesach? The counting of the Omer. And right, at least one of the theories for why that song came into the Seder was as a way of reminding people to count. Right? Because people, right, if you go to shul, you count it in shul on the first night. If you don't go to shul, you have to remember to count, because tonight is the first night, so you count at the Seder. So you have a song all about numbers. And once we're talking about numbers, we have this fun number song of all the different things that numbers represent. If that's the case, right, it wraps together a lot of what's going on in Nirtza. Because in Nirtza, that last part of the Seder, a lot of the songs, right, once we've gotten to the end, focus specifically, and this comes to a point we made before, not on the past, but on the future. Right? So we have Lashana Habab Yerushalayim, which is right at the beginning of Nirtza, where we're looking forward to the future. But even without some messianic future you're looking forward to, starting the counting of the Omer and singing Echad Miyodeh to remind you is looking forward to just 7 weeks from now, right, to looking forward to Shu'it. But more specifically, one of the questions at the Seder that should be running through our minds is, are we focusing only on what happened or why it happened? Right? And the Seder is about both. It's what happened, but also why it happened. Why did God take us out of Egypt? For what purpose? And the answer was, He, as God says, I took you out of Egypt to not to be free, but to be my slaves. Right? To be my people, to be my slaves. So Pesach is looking forward already to Shavuot, to looking forward to when we got the Torah, when we became a nation with God's laws and God's values and everything like that.
I took you out to make you slaves.
I know, it's, well, you know, that's what he says, you know, but I took you out to be mine, right? And all the values that does. So Echad Miyodea, which focuses on those numbers, that counting up is actually a way of just emphasizing the fact that part of the Seder is not just what happened, but why did it happen, what are we looking towards? And really much of the Exodus story circles around that point. I'll just, you know, note that, right, when Moses first meets God at the burning bush, right, it's on
holy ground.
Yeah, and what ground is that? It's our Sinai, right? It's right, because God tells him, and you will come back and you will serve me on this mountain, right? The story begins and ends with that moment, right? That he is chosen and said, you are going to come back here. So the whole Exodus story is looking towards that moment of why are we going out, for what purpose, so that we come back and can serve God in this place. So Echad Miyodea, that looking forward to the Omer, that count, starting that count, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc., etc., I think is also part, a very strong part of the message of the Seder. Okay, so now back to the source sheets, and I will not talk too much about this. I will just note that, and I will just set this up, and then I will give it over to Nancy. So, the Talmud says, I will just set up where this comes from. This Talmud, and this is in 14, says, in every generation, a man is bound to see himself, lirod et atzmo, as if he had personally gone forth from Egypt, because it is said, and you shall tell your son on that day, saying, it's because of that which the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt. Now, Maimonides has a different text there. Not lirod et atzmo, to see yourself, but leharot et atzmo, which is to make yourself look as if you came out of Egypt. Now, this custom, this led to a custom, which has had many, 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 many different versions of it, of people acting out the Seder. Now, most people think, I will just note one thing from this. Most people think that this custom is a Svardi custom, because nowadays, most of the people who do it are Svardim, and not Ashkenazim. What Rabbi, professor, doctor, whatever title he goes by, the combination, Galinkin, right? What?
Herr Galinkin.
What?
Herr professor,
yeah.
Doctor.
Yeah, exactly, whatever it is, right? He's the head of Machon Schechter. He was, whatever he is, exactly. So he notes, right, this is widespread, different versions of it among Sephardic and Oriental Jews, and he lists a few of them, and you can read them yourself. I just took this from an article online where he lists different customs that he's collected over the years, and Nancy is going to mention a few that she's had. I'll just note, if you skip down, though, to four here, in the middle of four in his numbering, right, I just quoted from him, he writes that, and this I just found interesting, surprisingly enough, this custom is first mentioned in Germany 650 years before Benjamin II described it in Asia, and is documented in Poland in the 16th century, in Germany and Hungary in the 20th. Meaning, Svardim do it nowadays, but it was originally an Ashkenazi custom, which I did not know, and I learned that that Ashkenazim started it, then we forgot about it. And he writes that the first version of it is Rav Asher of Lunel in Sefer HaMinhagot, 1210 in Provence, in southern France, writes that, I heard that in Alamein, in Germany, after eating karpas, they uproot the table, take the matzah, wrap them in covering, and bear them on their shoulders, and walk to the corners of the house. And then they return to their places and recite the Haggadah. And then he notes that this continues as an Ashkenazi custom, in addition to a Sephardi custom. He writes, from Shlomo Luria, writing the 16th century, has this custom. And he even writes that in 1951, this is in the next page, Professor Alexander Scheiber documented similar customs among his students at the rabbinical seminary in Budapest, who came from the Hungarian towns of, I cannot pronounce these, but Satmar, Zeppelin, Vats, Sisfolger, and Puntak. In the latter town, when they reached Yachatz, the breaking of the matzah, the father would wrap the afikomen in a scarf, put it on his shoulder, stand up and say to his family in Yiddish, there you go, let us go, let us go. And apparently, I didn't know this, the custom has survived among German Jews until today. And when I lectured on this topic in Jerusalem before Pesach in 1991, a woman told me that in Karlsruhe, in southern Germany, her father would put the matzah wrapped in the, I'll just read the English, white matzah cover on his shoulder and say that. Anyone who can read Yiddish can read that.
The children
of Israel leave Egypt, so it was. So apparently, this was a custom that wasn't just Tzvardi, it actually apparently originated amongst Ashkenazim and has different versions you can read here. He has all, they're actually fascinating. You can just read through the versions that he records here from Yemen, from Asia, from Morocco, etc., which will lead into Nancy telling us about the specific customs that she saw at the Seder in France, and then Diane, yes, and then we'll go to yours. So, Nancy, give it to you.
I was in Paris for Pesach. I was traveling, and I signed up for a Seder. Yes, in the Latin Quarter. So it was a mixture of French students, French middle-class people, tourists like me, and a lot of Moroccans, because Moroccans had moved to Paris. So it was very interesting. We had the walking, and the guy dressed up in like a shepherd's costume with a crook, and the questions, as here, a slightly different source. But there were basically three, and he put the afikomen, or a piece of matzah, in a little fabric thing over his shoulder, and he marched around, and people said, where do you come from? And he said, Egypt. Where are you going? Jerusalem. What do you take with you? The matzah. So it was a way of enacting not only the Seder, but the Exodus, because we're told to take the unleavened dough and put it on our shoulders and run. So allegedly, that's why we eat matzah. You know, God planned it so that the dough wouldn't rise, so it's different. So that was one custom. Another custom, there's three total, was they took the Seder plate and they waved it over my head. Now, they told me it was for fertility. I have no idea if that was true, if it was a come on. In sources I've looked up since then, they say it's two things, and they're opposite. One is that you should feel the weights, like we went around like with slaves, you know, like you've seen these pictures from Africa, and balanced all these heavy things on our heads or on our shoulders. So it was the weight of the oppression, or because of the symbols of the Seder plate, it's freedom. So take your pick. As with many things, there are many explanations.
Did they have a special prayer every time they... Because my brother-in-law does that. He's from Morocco, but he doesn't do it with the Seder plate. He does it with the matzah, and he goes to each one on top of their head.
No, they did it with us, to each person, but with the plate. But when I asked Moroccan friends, and this is interesting, when I asked Canadian friends who'd worked in Morocco for several years about this custom, they said they'd had the plate waved over their heads, but nobody there could explain it, and my informant said he thought it was German. So he said, maybe you had it in Paris because of the Jews from Alsace.
Oh.
So this is interesting, or Provence is another source. Mm. So I don't know where it came from. I experienced it in Paris with French and Moroccans. And the third part is wonderful, because you talked about telling your own story. And wherever we are, we incorporate either our personal stories or our environmental stories into our Seder tellings. You don't realize this until you go to Israel and you hear Hebrew in a different accent than yours. I'm American, I hear American, I thought that was the way you speak Hebrew. But there's Hungarian and there's Spanish and there's French and there's German. You hear the different accents. The leader of the Seder was this very elegantly dressed middle-aged Frenchman. And he got up in the middle and he gave a discourse about freedom. And I'm listening, and I hear rationality, and I hear outlines, and I hear deductions. And I thought, of course, it's Descartes. Wow. Descartes at the Seder table.
Wow.
So if you're here, you're going to hear peace, order, and good government. If you're in the United States, you're going to hear Jefferson Jews. And if you're in France, you're going to have Cartesian rationality.
Wow. Isn't that interesting?
I should
Thank
have
you,
Nancy. That. The philosophy major in me is like, you
Wonderful.
Know.
So those are my three stories from Paris.
Wow.
I have a loud voice.
Okay.
Very good. Yes.
My voice is really loud. So first of all, you mentioned Chag Miodeah, and in Hebrew we say Shnei Luchot HaBrit, the two tablets. But in Spanish, because this actually, it was interesting. He mentioned the Haggadah of the Sephardic Jews of Seattle, which I happen to have, just by fluke. And in Spanish, in our Spanish, in Ladino, we say. Dos is Moshe y Aaron. We don't say Shtei Luchot HaBrit, we say Moses and Aaron. I've always learned it that way, and I had to bring it to make sure I read it right. So that was one thing. Our Seders are done in many languages. We do Spanish, we do Ladino, we do French, Italian, Greek. We even do Chinese.
Wow.
Which my husband, this is actually a Hebrew Haggadah, but it was brought from the Jews of China. This is a copy of the whatever. And my husband actually, when he gets to a certain point, he does read Chinese, but that's not it. He translates it all to Chinese. We actually eat barbecue, which I know most Ashkenazi Jews do not. I just lost the page that I wanted to hold. But anyways, unbeknownst to me, because my parents are survivors from Greece, so their customs, a lot of things are what they remember, we eat lamb on Pesach. That's like geschriben. And we eat it with peas. Peas. And it's interesting because I know we don't eat rice, although we do now, because we eat fresh beans and we eat fresh green beans and we eat fresh peas. And since my daughter's vegetarian, I figured if we eat beans and peas, we can darn well eat hummus and all the other things. Although my mother every year says, this is dried and you're not supposed to eat dried, but we eat dried. And my father will say that when he first came to Canada and he stayed with my mother's adoptive family, who were very Orthodox people, he said they had potatoes.
Mm.
And potatoes are not for Pesach, which I thought was very interesting. So you see different customs. And the last thing, so my mother always says, she never knew why, and that's the reason I actually bought this book, was because I was searching for my mom to find the reason. She says, I remember as a little girl that at the last day of Pesach, we would go out somewhere and we would take all the Pesach food and we would eat it, whatever was left over, and we would bring grass and bring it back and put it in the corners of the house. That's a custom I never heard, I never knew, and she says, I have no idea why, and so my life job was to try and find the answer. So I did find it something in this book, and it says...
He's Ashkenazi, by the way.
Who? This guy, Dobrinsky. But he did a very good research on it.
What book did
it? It's called...
Patriots of Barnett Lazen.
He says, there are beautiful customs enacted by the grandfather or the father at the conclusion of the last night of Pesach. They pick some fresh grass and bring it home. Then some throw the grass, money, and wrapped candy on the floor for the children to pick up. It is called the Praça en Agua Lavadora, which is for which there's a special song. The ceremony symbolizes that one may now eat the wheat of chametz and expresses the hope for a good summer and a green, productive year. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I've never heard it before, but I think it's a nice song.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So,
thank you. Yeah. This one?
Yeah. It always struck me as odd as soon as Pesach is over, the poor women of Morocco have to prepare this menu.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.